Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
They really mean is not that the government shouldn't spend a lot, because if they meant that, they would say, let's cut military spending. Let's cut spending that is, you know, padding the pockets of the rich, but producing nothing of social value. They would say that, but they don't. They don't mean the government shouldn't spend. What they mean is the government shouldn't collect revenues across the country and spend it on behalf of the population. They should just spend it on behalf of the rich.
That's the voice of economist and author Michael Albert. On this week's show, we speak to Michael about the priorities in a capitalist system and the need and ability for citizens to think differently, creating new alternatives. So stay tuned.
Someone who has written extensively about realizing that hope, his book, Realizing Hope, Life Beyond Capitalism, is Dr. Michael Albert. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we live in a society where invariably the discussion is always around the economy. And for those who are conservative, the big slogan is strong economy, and cut taxes. And it seems a very simplistic way of seeing society, but there are implications within that narrative. What does a narrative that describes us as being solely organized around financial capital, what are some of the implications that it has in our lives?
A strong economy, well, that could mean a lot of things, right? I mean, what exactly is strong? What they mean by a strong economy is an economy which is delivering profits to the people at the top at a nice, you know, pace, or even an excellent pace. So that's a strong economy in their view. If the economy is polluting at a heavy level but delivering lots of profits, strong. If the economy is, you know, wasting away people's lives at workplaces that are poorly designed and that are oppressive and that rob dignity, no problem. That's strong. I mean, think about if somebody a long time ago had said, let's have a strong plantation system in the South. They didn't mean good for the slaves. They meant good for the landowners. And the people who talk about a strong economy now typically mean that, too. That is good for the owners. If we use the term strong economy, it might mean something different. It might mean, well, an economy that doesn't just pile up stuff, or that doesn't just pile up profits, but that actually piles up happy people. An economy that piles up, that generates people who care about one another, who have a sense of dignity, who have a sense of control over their lives. That, to me, would be a strong economy. Not really. I wouldn't use the word strong, but if I had to, I'd use it that way. I would say worthy, or desirable, or humane, or anything like that. So when the narrative is twisted around, when the story that we tell leaves out some stuff and puts in some stuff, it hurts us. If the stuff that's left out is everything that matters to us, and the stuff that's included is only what matters to them, the rich owners. And that's what this is about. So, what does the government say not spending a lot have to do with a good or a worthy economy, or even a strong economy? It doesn't mean anything. What they really mean is not that the government shouldn't spend a lot, because if they meant that, they would say, let's cut military spending. Let's cut spending that is, you know, padding the pockets of the rich, but producing nothing of social value. They would say that, but they don't. They don't mean the government shouldn't spend. What they mean is the government shouldn't collect revenues across the country and spend it on behalf of the population. They should just spend it on behalf of the rich. So you're right, you know, precisely right, that the words and the meaning that they carry narrows our focus and takes it away from just about everything that's important and puts it instead on benefiting them It's almost as if you're on a plantation, you're a slave, and the total discussion is about whether or not the guy who is getting the profits from the sale of the cotton is well off. But that's the only thing that's discussed. And that would obviously be, a joke, a travesty. That's where we are.
One of the interesting, I think to me anyways, is the relationship to power. You write about the power of people to transform their society, our ability to transform. For a long time, we have been told that we're unable to change society, that it is fixed, that, history ended and capitalism is here to stay. Why is this narrative so prevalent, and how does it become internalized? And
It's about the most important message that people who are taking for themselves the biggest share, the biggest part of the societal output, can spread. It is absolutely important. If you have a society in which lots and lots and lots of people are denied, have less than a person ought to have, it's absolutely important to get everybody to believe there's nothing that can be done about it. Nobody in modern societies thinks that, the crime rate, the level of indignity that is endured while doing work, the frustrations of dealing with, bureaucracies, the indignities of racism and sexism, nobody thinks those things are good. Everybody thinks those things are bad. War, bad. Everybody thinks these things are horrible. Like, a cancer is horrible. A disease is horrible. Okay, it's horrible. But if it's just the way it is, if it's just, and that's the message, if it's just tough, it's life, bear up and do the best you can. If that's the belief, then there's nothing really to do about it. Then there's nothing to do except in an isolated fashion try to make the best of it. But the minute that the belief changes to, wait a second, if we operate within the norms, the way they're defined by our workplaces and our neighborhoods and everything else, if we behave the way the system tells us to behave, then indeed we will change nothing. But if we step outside of that and we act in different ways that are aimed at changing things, we can. Look at the events in the Mideast, say in Egypt. I mean, Egypt is rolling along year after year, decade after decade, with a horrendously repressive system. Now, it didn't get nirvana, but they didn't try for nirvana. They didn't try for the best system possible. They tried to overthrow the system that they had, and they succeeded rather quickly. That's incredible. And 4 months before, every person in Egypt, virtually every person, almost all of them, would have said, well, that's not happening anytime soon. And most of them would have said, that's not ever happening. They'd have been wrong. And that belief that there is no alternative, the belief that you can't make change. Those two things, you can't fight City Hall, is the way it's said in the United States. Those two sort of pessimistic views are the strongest bulwark of, the strongest defense of injustice, and always have been. There's nothing new about that. It's always been the case. Once those beliefs dissipate, the possibility of change, and even the virtual inevitability of change, becomes the guiding theme.
I want to talk about the difference between imperialism and colonization, because we hear these terms interchangeably, we hear them in our schools, but we don't really associate any real meaning to them. These are sort of these code words that are exchanged by those who know and who organize our military officials to go and bring democracy to other places. And so what should we understand about these two defining concepts and that are materialized in the lives of other people abroad and in our own lives here in Canada and the U.S.
Yeah, a lot of these words, I think, people think they mean a lot because people throw them around, but if you push hard, the people throwing them around don't know what they mean either. So I don't even use those words, or I rarely use them. Instead, I talk about the actual reality. So imperialism, colonialism, what are these things about? Well, one country operates within another country to control, literally, to control the day-to-day life of the country. Colonialism, England and India, and so on. Imperialism, one country sort of engages with another in such a way as to extract from it a large amount of its social product to benefit the former. In other words, it's ripping it off. One country is ripping off another. That's the most general term. So you could imagine an imperial relationship, even though the imperial country isn't occupying the other one. Colonialism isn't, you know, setting up the government and running the society of the other one. In fact, you can imagine it without any hostilities at all. Just as long as there's a very substantial to massive flow of wealth from the one to the other. That's an imperial relationship, if you like. But you don't need to use those catch terms. You just need to realize, look, one country shouldn't be ripping off another, nor should it be dominating another. That's just no way to conduct international relations or social life. Of course, it's what the United States does routinely all over the world, virtually all the time, but that doesn't make it right. It just makes it horrendous and something that needs to change.
Well, some of the weapons that are used now, you know, we used to talk about colonization in Latin America in terms of armies coming in, you know, with boats and occupying the nations, sure, as you point out. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between a capitalist system that is focused on profits and ability to enable that kind of imperialism to not only become prevalent, but to also become the determining factor of how everything is organized in our communities?
Yeah. I mean, capitalism is just a system. We all know what it is. I mean, everybody knows. It's a system in which you have private ownership. You have a relatively few people who own all the tools and the means of production and the workplaces and so on, and who benefit from that. And as a result, they want to turn all productive activity into something that they can benefit from. So everything is privatized. As much as you possibly can is privatized. And over time, it's more and more and more. So that, you know, when you stand on the subway, the subway lines are billboards. And slowly but surely, every space, every inch is transformed into a vehicle for these vast private institutions, corporations, to try and make more profits. And it happens not just because people are greedy or something like that. It happens because the structure of the economy is such that you must do that. It isn't just that you're going out of your way to, you know, to do something out of the ordinary and to keep going and that. You have to do it. The market competitive system is such that if you don't do it, you lose and you go backwards and you even fail completely. So you're driven to do it. So it's another way to think about imperialism. Think about the relationship between Manhattan, you know, and the poor parts of New York, or Manhattan and the rest of the country. Similarly for places in Canada or other countries. In other words, capitalism creates a dynamic in which there are centers of power and wealth, and those centers try to retain their power and wealth and try to expand it, which means others are reduced and are made weaker and poorer. Well, even inside countries, that's the same basic dynamic as between countries. And even between countries, if you think about it. So take the UK and India, okay, a classic example of colonialism. Well, there were people in India who benefited. And not only that, while the rich in the UK benefited, the poor didn't. So it's not a relationship between countries. It's a relationship in which elites are ripping off the population of another country, or at least large parts of it. I'm told that at the height of the British Empire, Britain would spend $2 in India, say $2 billion, for every one that they would get back. Now that seems insane, right? That seems, okay, so why did the rich in Britain do that? Why would the rich go to rip off another country and it cost $2 to get back every one? Well, the reason was because the two were the $2 of everybody in Britain. So in other words, taxes would generate $2 out of the entire population of Britain's income, and that the $2 would be spent ripping off India, and the $1 that came back would go to the rich. So in a very weird way, it was a redistribution of wealth from the entire population of England to the rich in England by way of machinations in India, which also hurt them. I mean, it is a sick system. It is, you know, organized in such a way that each set of phenomenon, if you look closely, the prevalent, the ubiquitous, the all-the-time dynamic is that the poor and the weak are being shafted on behalf of the rich and the powerful. And it's built into the structure. That's why it has to go.
One of the options that we have is to either accommodate and adjust, which some people have done, but I think the majority of people are uncomfortable with a system that is so inequitable. And you propose that there are alternatives, that as creative human beings, we have the capacity and the capability to create alternatives to this system. How do we create an alternative that not only allows us a voice at the table and to create, collectively, a society that is respectful of our needs and meets our needs?
What we're talking about, if we're really talking about going from the abomination that exists, and it really is that, to something really desirable, really, really good, is changing the basic social relations, changing the way people are organized together to accomplish things like production and consumption, political decision making, you know, the way we organize our cultures and our home life and so on. So you're talking about fundamentally transforming those things. Well, that's what a revolution is. That's what it really ought to be, the term ought to mean. It has nothing to do with violence, and it has nothing to do with how fast. It's that you're fundamentally transforming the basic relations of society. Okay, so your question is, how do we do that? Well, that's a big question. But what we know we don't do, what we know won't work, is to simply follow the guidelines and the norms of the existing system. Again, think of any other situation in history and it becomes obvious. If the slaves on the plantation abide the norms of slavery, it'll be there forever. If the population under the kings and royalty abide the norms and the logic of that system, it'll be there forever. At some point, people have to say, well, wait a second, the system sucks, and it's not inevitable, and we could have a different one, just like in the past they could have a different one. And so what we have to do is operate according to a different logic. I mean, we're constrained somewhat, because the system is still this bad system, and I've got to go to work each day, and I can't just, tell my boss to flake off. Can't do that yet. But what I can do, and the same thing with the laws out on the street, but what I can do is I can begin to think about, okay, what would a different society look like? And I can begin to group with other people, and I can begin to make demands for changes that move toward that different society and that build a larger and larger constituency of people who desire that different society and who work toward that different society. If you actually look, say, at Egypt again, Egypt didn't just pop out of no place, those rebellions. You know, for years, there's been growing labor activity and growing activity among youth in Egypt and growing thoughts, divergences from the commonplace thoughts into something new. And all of that sort of congealed together into, just as a result of some events in Tunisia, into an outpouring that gave people hope. And then they just carried on courageously against, formidable opposition. And lacking, I think, this is my own opinion, lacking clarity about what a really good society would be, I'm not sure they're going to get anywhere near it. They're going to get rid of the dictatorship, but they're not going to arrive at what they all sort of really are desiring, true freedom, true participation, true dignity. that may well dissipate into a system more like ours. But that doesn't say they couldn't have. They could have. And we can too.
I think in your book, Parenkon, you actually provide some examples of how we can organize a society where people have a say at the table and how that society can be shaped. Talk a little bit about the contradiction of having a society where we declare ourselves as being the freest and to have democratic ideals, while at the same time condone or allowed for the invasion of other people, like, you know, the case right now in Libya. How is this logic contradictory to those ideals or democratic principles that we profess?
Libya is for some people a more complicated place, complicated case than, say, Iraq or Afghanistan and so on. But as far as motives are concerned, it's pretty much the same across the board. It's the U.S. and other elite countries, when the U.S. allows it, other Western countries that have the means, when the U.S. allows it, acting on behalf of their own interests, acting on behalf of, that's that imperial dynamic, of their own wealth and power. I suspect that the main reason that the Europeans are so wrought up about this and about Libya is because they're afraid of Libyan immigration. I suspect that that may be the driving impetus. People talk about oil and the like. Well, first of all, Gaddafi was completely compliant regarding the oil. There's no particular problem there. What they're worried about now, I think, is events in Libya leading to a massive migration of Libyans into Europe. And they're trying to forestall that. So, at the same time, they want to increase the control of the West over oil. Why? Well, not on behalf of the people of Libya, not on behalf of the people of the Mideast, and not on behalf even of the people of the West, of the United States, rather on behalf of the people who own oil companies and other companies dependent on oil. That's who, you've said a few times, sitting at the table. Well, that's who sits at the table. That's the only people who sit at the table. The owners, the rich, the powerful, some of their agents. They're at the table. We shouldn't even have that kind of decision-making in which a relatively small sector of people, no matter who it is, right, is making decisions for everybody else. We should rather have truly democratic, true self-management, true decision-making in which people's wills are manifested.
One of the things that I think we need to remember, as you point out, is that we are capable of imagining those alternative different futures for our society. How do we break, then, through the straitjacket, I think, that self-identification with the interests of the rich and powerful have imposed on us, as we see the interests of Walmart as our own, perhaps?
First of all, if we assume this system is going to last forever, the way it is, then thinking that your interests are sort of entwined isn't so crazy. It's in other words, people aren't dumb. Again, suppose you live on a slave plantation, and you assume that the slave plantation is going to go on forever, and that you will be a slave until you die on this plantation. Well, then, it's very true that the quality of your life probably has a great deal to do with the mood and the inclinations and the conditions of the person who owns that plantation. That's true, because they are in charge. So in that sense, there's some truth to it. If what we do is we accept the system and we accept its operations, then there's some truth to it. But the minute that we don't do that, the minute that we think a little differently, there's not. So take any issue you want. Let's assume for a minute that we're talking about somebody who goes to work each day at some workplace or other. Let's say they work in an auto plant. So they go to work in an auto plant. They do, repetitive tasks in an assembly process over and over. They have no decision-making say. If they want to go to the bathroom, they may well have to ask the line boss, and so on. So their dignity is reduced. They've got a reasonable income because they've got a union, but it's certainly less than it ought to be. The quality of their work is less. They're constantly worried about unemployment and on and on. So what if they began to think, well, wait, how could the work in this workplace be organized in such a way that I had my share, my rightful share of control over it, and that those people who were pushing us around were instead working like we are and having a share just like ours. And the minute you start thinking about that, you begin to conceive of a different way of organizing a workplace and a different way of distributing the fruits of work and the benefits of work and also the costs of work that's fair and that's equitable. I mean, we could talk about that. It's not magic and it's not that complicated, except one thing: stepping out of the straitjacket of accepting that it must be the way it is. That's the big step. That's the hard step. Not only to make it once, but to keep out there, you know, to keep understanding that you don't have to accept things the way it is and that you can think about things. That's a big step. But once you've made that step, the rest is not all that hard.
That's so beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Michael Albert. His book, Realizing Hope, Life Beyond Capitalism. How can people access your books?
Well, a number of them are online, so people could go to Z Communications or ZNet, www.zcommunications.org. The name of the economic system I favor is called participatory economics, and the name of the type of society is participatory society, and people can find tons about that on that site, which also, of course, you know, has all sorts of other stuff. It's a very large site, and it covers world affairs and domestic affairs and issues of gender and race and class and so on, all from a very radical perspective that's informed by those kinds of visions. So that's one way. Another way is to just go to something like Amazon and look up Michael Albert, I guess, and you'll find a host of books, and, you know, one might be of interest.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having
me.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.